There have been some recent developments in Mormon studies. The Joseph Smith Papers Project, there have been some university chairs around the country, some exciting developments. Talk about some of the prospects that you see.
Well, you know, people talk about the late 1960s, 70s as the age of Camelot under Leonard Arrington, and I'm sure they were, but if that's the case, then this may be a second Camelot, I hope, they're about to enter into now. I think that the Mountain Meadows Massacre book, I think the generally positive reception of Rough Stone Rolling, which was a fairly honest and unairbrushed account of Joseph Smith, the rigor and openness with which the Joseph Smith papers are being produced, presented to the public, all of these are terrific signs of a general a kind of maturity on the part of, I think, Mormon culture to address our past more openly and honestly. And I look and hope we see more of the same kind of developments.
Mormonism's always had an interest in history, I think all the way going back, but it's been a particular type of history and more of an advocacy history. Do you see that continuing? And what are some of the uses behind that type of a history compared to a more strictly academic history?
Well, I think it's been pointed out before that Mormon history for the first 100 and more years was almost always written either by vicious critics or overzealous defenders. And so it's been very hard to stake out a middle ground in Mormon historiography. But I think we're seeing the emergence of that now. I think to the extent that we have Mormon studies programs springing up and Mormon professorships springing up, I think that has forced a kind of professionalization which avoids the extremes of both kind of unwarranted criticism on the one hand and overzealous apologetics on the other.
What are some of the benefits of that professionalization and maybe some of the drawbacks of it as well?
Well, I think, you know, the church leaders have rightly seen themselves as watchmen on the tower, and I think that the principal purpose of history in the church's past has been to strengthen and edify. What has changed in recent years is the accessibility of the full historical record. And so I think what we're coming to recognize is that if we only teach a sanitized view of church history, it's not about professional standards. For me, that's not the issue. The issue is that if members are going to develop strong and viable testimonies, faith that is predicated on truth, then they have to be given access to the full story of their faith. Otherwise, they will learn the truth from sources more hostile to the church, and then what they will experience is not enlightenment, but a feeling of betrayal. And so my concern is that we teach the history honestly and rigorously enough that we forestall and preclude any possibility of them ever feeling that they were betrayed by their own teachers and institutions.
You mentioned Rough Stone Rolling from Richard Bushman's the author there, a biography of Joseph Smith. And that book tries to take a really honest, hard look at who Joseph Smith was and what he did. And in Bushman's very short introduction to Mormonism, he talks about outsiders looking at Mormons and saying, nice people, strange beliefs. And that kind of comes back to Joseph, this man who said he spoke with angels and had a set of gold plates and these kind of wacky things that we believe. Where do you find yourself there? You're a guy who likes to think.
Yeah, it was Charles Dickens, I think, in 1851, who said what the Mormons say is absurd. What they believe, what they do is mostly excellent. And Mormons have responded to that criticism by being complicit in what it implies. And here's what I mean by that. In the first several generations of Mormonism, from at least 1830 until about 1893, Mormons were portrayed either as frauds or philanderers. And Mormons were put on the defensive, and so the pamphlet wars largely became wars over things like the Solomon Spaulding manuscript or Joseph Smith's character. And then they became attacks on and defenses of polygamy from 1853 until 1893. Finally, in 1893, what the church discovered was that if they tried to represent themselves as Christians, as they did at the World Parliament of Religions, they were shut down. But if they tried to represent themselves as great singers in the form of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, then they became America's sweetheart. And the lesson that they learned from that was that if we are willing to be seen by the world as a cultural entity, then we can be accepted and loved. But nobody will take us seriously if we try to present ourselves in terms of a particular theology or belief system.
And that seems to me one of the reasons you did through People of Paradox was you were looking at how Mormons became more acceptable in American culture, and one of the ways they did that was through the arts, or we have the Osmonds, for example. And you've mentioned that if you put up some recognizable Mormons from the last 100 years, you're going to see people like Steve Young, you're going to see people like the Osmonds. You're not necessarily going to see an Einstein or a great American thinker. Do you see that changing in the future?
Well, I don't know that it will. There's a pattern in the past that we could follow that would signify a paradigm shift, and that's the pattern that Parley Pratt exemplified in 1838. He was the first one, really, who, when confronted with a hostile press, in this case it was a series of articles written by the Methodist minister Leroy Sunderland, accusing the Mormons of believing in such outrageous doctrines as deification, Pratt's response was to say, "You bet we do, and here's why." And so he took the offensive. And he threw red meat to the critics and said, "You want to talk doctrine? Let's talk doctrine. And I'll go to the wall defending these things that you consider absolutely blasphemous and outrageous." Our attitude since then has been to downplay Mormon particularism. And the whole strategy reminds me sometimes of people in the lifeboats trying to get back to the Titanic. What we see time and time again in the contemporary Protestant world especially is that people are fleeing the old forms of Protestantism looking for an alternative. What Mormonism offers is a radical, dramatic alternative to creedal Christianity. And it just seems odd to me that Mormons often run from rather than embrace that radical difference.
There's a strange tension there, too, even within the church. For example, President Hinckley's interview, I believe it was with Larry King, where whoever the interviewer was brought up the idea that God was once a man, and President Hinckley sidestepped the question. But then in the next priesthood manual that came out, the Joseph Smith manual, we have a bunch of selections from the King Fala Discourse. So we have this. Do you think that's more of a public versus private, or do you see Mormons taking a step away from the particularism even within the church?
Well, I think there's divided sentiment in the church. I think there's divided sentiment within individuals. I think there was divided sentiment within Joseph Smith's own mind. If you look at the Articles of Faith, it's a strange schizophrenic document, because he begins by saying, "We're just like you. We believe in God, Christ, and the Holy Ghost." And then in the very next breath he says, "But we completely reject all of Christianity's teachings about inherited guilt and original sin. But we believe in the Bible. But we also believe in the Book of Mormon." But he doesn't talk about preexistence. He doesn't talk about exaltation. So in part it may be just a question of tactics. When is it appropriate to lead out with a radical doctrine? When is the danger of alienation and estrangement so great that we have to soft pedal some of the more iconoclastic teachings? So I don't presume to know. I just think that we should be aware of the fact that, as I said, Pratt and others have shown the possibility of a more vigorous and robust approach.
You mentioned Parley P. Pratt and the way that he engaged the pamphleteers. It seemed that he spent quite a bit of time writing and responding and also engaging in thought with other religionists of his time. Have you finished the book on Parley P. Pratt?
Matt Groh and I have finished the biography of Parley Pratt. It's now circulating with some fellow scholars for their comment and criticisms. And when we work out our last revisions, we will be sending that to the press in the next few months.
Did anything surprise you as you looked at Parley Pratt? I assume that's the closest you'd looked at him.
Yes, it was. I think I was surprised by a few things. One was I knew that he was important as an early theologian, but I hadn't begun to fathom the extent to which the Mormonism that we today believe and practice was given its essential form and shape by Parley Pratt. It would be impossible to exaggerate the extent to which he gave systematic order and form to Joseph Smith's theology. The second, I think, surprise, well, it shouldn't be a surprise to any biographer really, was the extent to which Parley told a particular story about himself in his autobiography, which is not always the same story that one can extract from all the available evidence. He was trying to tell a particular story and was concerned to present himself in a particular way, and for the most part, his story has honesty and integrity. But there are some very important elements that he left out that make for a more fully rounded character and a more complex character.
There's some fun stories from that autobiography. I remember reading as a missionary of his escape from arrest, where he was chased by a dog, and I've talked to you a little bit about that story, and you know, I love that story, but then give me a little bit more.
There's a little more to this story. He creates the impression in his autobiography that he was arrested for preaching the Book of Mormon. It was on his way to the Lamanite mission, and he was in Ohio with three others. And he talks in his autobiography of being accosted by a constable in the middle of testifying of the Book of Mormon and hauled away to jail. And as we were working on this portion of the biography, it occurred to me that there were a few things that didn't quite add up. One was that there were four of them. Why was he the only one arrested? The other is he said he was arrested on a frivolous charge, but for a man who was so good about details, why didn't he tell us exactly what that charge was? And then third...
Well, it was frivolous.
It was frivolous, yeah. And then third and finally, I thought, now wait a minute, he lived in this same town just a few years before. And so as we looked into the records, we found a newspaper account which indicated that he had been arrested for debt, that he had apparently fled a few years before, or at least left town without resolving all of his financial obligations, and so they were waiting for him with a warrant when he returned. And I'm sure that in his mind, the arrest was aggravated and the hostility inflamed by the fact that he was now a Mormon missionary. So I think he probably didn't see what he was doing as misrepresenting the truth, but it wasn't the whole picture.
Yeah, and I think that takes me back to the Moss quote of abandoned certainty. There's also a sense of needing to abandon some, or at least change some of my previous favorite little stories, and I think that's a good example of that. And I think that's a good reason to read history a little bit closer. Another book that you've written that we haven't mentioned yet, When Souls Had Wings, was published by Oxford, and it's a historical look at the idea of pre-existence. What got you interested in that?
Well, there's a long genealogy behind that book. I'd start by saying that one of the most interesting things about Joseph's view of restoration was that the first revelation he received in 1829 that mentioned the church referred to the establishment of the church. And that was published as Section 4 of the Book of Commandments. When he recast that for Section 5 of the Doctrine and Covenants, he changed the language in highly significant ways. He had the Lord referring to the coming forth out of the wilderness of the church. And he deliberately took that language from the book of Revelation. And what happens in that allegory that is given us by John is that the church is not taken from the earth, but it retreats into the wilderness where it is nourished. And this reading came to me from my wife, who I think with her Catholic background and sensibility perceived that this is a very different paradigm of the restoration and apostasy, because what it suggests is that the truth was never completely gone from the earth, that the Spirit has always nourished honest in heart people. President Kimball used to say, when God doesn't have prophets, he speaks to the poets. And so I began to think about this in connection with this doctrine of preexistence, because as a scholar of Romanticism, I couldn't help but notice that almost every major figure of the early 19th century in Britain and Germany had some version of the preexistence that seeped into their poetry. Wordsworth is only the most famous. So I decided to do a study inspired by what I thought to be Joseph Smith's model of how truth operates in the world, to see where else has this idea appeared. And I was just astonished to find that it's appeared in religious texts going back to 2000 BC in Mesopotamia. Platonic literature is, of course, full of the idea of preexistence. Jewish tradition, early Christian tradition, the Apostolic Fathers, the Cambridge Platonists of the 17th century, Kabbalists and esotericists, Renaissance humanists, 19th century German idealists. It's everywhere. And so I did a study in which I surveyed the scope of the idea, not to assess how plausible or believable is this idea, but to ask what questions does this view of human existence answer? What is it responsive to that our hearts yearn for? And in asking this question, I thought that there was much that we as Latter-day Saints could learn about what kind of cultural or intellectual or religious work does the idea of preexistence do that we haven't been aware of, because we've only seen it through the narrow lens of our own religious tradition.
Right. There seems to be a danger in looking at the past through one's own religious lens in terms of finding what you want to find in, oh, you know, Joseph got it right, that sort of an attitude. Now, your book avoids that. How did you go about avoiding that?
Well, I think I avoid it because I sincerely hold that idea in contempt. I think that to the extent that we think that Mormonism is the only source or repository of truth, we're being unfaithful to Joseph Smith's tradition, his teachings, and his example. I wanted to study the idea of preexistence because I genuinely wanted to learn what else is there to be learned from the power and potency of this idea. And I think that we could do this with all Latter-day Saint doctrines. We could be asking the question, well, who else has taught or believed this? What might we learn from their particular representation of this idea or doctrine? Joseph said, right, that we need to embrace the truth wherever we find it and make it part of Mormonism. And so that was a meager attempt to do just that.
As we look through Mormon history and Mormon doctrine, once in a while people run into difficulties. Today I know people have struggled with the idea of plural marriage. Some people have wondered about blacks in the priesthood, or some of these things that we run into that might cause us to pause and question a little bit. Do you have some advice for what you do or what people can do when they run into those more difficult areas?
Well, if certainty becomes a quest, then you spend all of your life chasing the loose threads of the gospel. And I think that what is lacking in Mormon culture is a greater appreciation for the value of faith itself. And I don't mean that as a kind of glib cop-out, that, well, we just trust, or we just believe, we can't make sense of things. But I mean that in some very deep-rooted existential way, the freedom to choose to believe is a kind of moral imperative. And if we were to ever reach a point in our lives where we felt the evidence for or against Christ's divinity, or the Book of Mormon, or Joseph Smith's prophetic calling, were overwhelming, then there would be a kind of intellectual compulsion involved, and our faith would not be a matter of choice. And so in my personal life, at least, I have developed, I think, an ability to value and even to cherish the opportunities that come to me frequently to define myself and to affirm my values by choosing to embrace one set of alternatives over another, when the evidence creates a condition of relative equilibrium, where there are good grounds to believe and there are good grounds to disbelieve. And then the question is, what do you affirm by the choice you make?
Another subject that I wanted to bring up was where Mormonism fits in with some of the great thinkers in that. When you've done your study on the pre-mortal thought in history, for example, you're dealing with some pretty big names. You're dealing with people who've struggled with some of the big questions. Do you ever feel that Mormonism has a provinciality to it, or do you feel like Mormonism has much to say to that broader discussion?
Well, you know, Gene England used to say that Mormonism suffers from a kind of provincial anti-provincialism, and I think that's a brilliant characterization of where we are all too often. I think that Mormons labor under a kind of inferiority complex, because it's true that Joseph Smith can't hold his own with the great systematic philosophers of the Western intellectual tradition. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of merit to what Sterling McMurn once said after he had written the philosophical or the theological foundations of Mormonism. A colleague complained to him that he made Mormonism out to look so much more intellectually substantial than it really was. And he said, well, that's true, but that's because Mormons make it out to look so much less intellectually substantial than it really is. And I think that when you compare Joseph Smith's anthropology, human and divine anthropology, to the other great religious systems of the West or of the world. I think that he holds his own very well. I think that there is an organic consistency to Joseph's overall conception of human origins and human futures that is intellectually sound and self-consistent. I think the other great virtue of Joseph Smith's thought is that it resonates in ways that, well, beginning in the early 19th century especially, people found to be true to their experience of what it meant to be human. I think that Joseph Smith gives a view of human agency, of human freedom, and of human potential that is not just intellectually self-consistent, but that is intuitively appealing. So I find that Joseph Smith actually fares quite well the more one delves into his writings and thought.
As Mormonism becomes more of a global faith, it obviously faces some challenges when it's trying to appeal to different cultures or trying to get the message in different areas of the world. And what are some of the ways you see the church as embracing more of a world perspective and maybe a little bit less of that provincialism?
Well, there are two questions here, it seems, that are really intertwined. One is, to what extent has Mormonism really been shaped and become indistinguishable in some regards from an American cultural inheritance? But I think it's also an interesting question to ask, to what extent has Mormonism become indistinguishable from a certain Protestant inheritance? I mean, we have many aspects of our religious culture that we think are tenets of the Mormon faith that actually are more just a kind of Protestant carryover. I'm thinking, for example, of the tendency to be much more literalist in our reading of scriptures than is typical of most others, and that's something that we inherited, I think, from a particular kind of Protestant literalism that influenced Parley Pratt and many of his contemporaries. I think culturally we have a lot of baggage that I think, for instance, of the Protestant work ethic as something that has infused Mormon thought. The fact that we have the beehive as a symbol means that we value activity to such an extent that the contemplative dimensions of life sometimes get pushed way too far to the side. I think our vocabulary reflects a kind of obsession with busyness that at times can be a little concerning. We talk about temple work and work for the dead, and Mormons aren't devout, Mormons are active or inactive. And I think that that as a result, we tend to be deficient in the area of creating a great devotional tradition and a great devotional literature that can be so rich in other religious traditions and is lacking in our own.
What are some examples of that? You know, as a person so interested in literature, what are some things from outside the LDS tradition that you've found to be a good devotional literature?
You mean just in my own personal reading?
Yeah.
Well, I find the Cambridge Platonists to be an especially rich and wonderful and inspiring group of writers. I'm thinking of people like Henry Moore and Thomas Traherne. These were a group of Cambridge clergymen who were absolutely committed to the idea of human preexistence and to what they called the idea of deification, but were extremely pious, devout, just spiritually centered individuals. I think there are many fathers in the early church tradition, Gregory of Nazianzus, who's one of my favorites. There are writers like William Law, who wrote A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life, which I think is the greatest devotional work ever written. The Thomas A. Kempis's Imitation of Christ. I mean, there are just a lot of these works that were staples of the Christian tradition for many centuries that Mormons, I think, tend to dismiss out of hand because they're part of the great apostasy, so to speak. And I think it may have been against such an attitude that Moroni was warning future readers. He warned not only to beware lest you call that which is good to be evil, but also, or not just that which is evil to be good, but also that which is good to be evil. I think I wish we had more of the generosity of spirit of a Joseph Smith, where we were more open and receptive to great sources of truth and beauty wherever they come from.
Do you see that coming out more recently, is that there seems to be kind of an openness to and a reaching out? And it seems to me it kind of began even more with President Hinckley, where he seemed to be very ecumenical.
Well, there's certainly a much more of an ecumenical emphasis in recent years, which I applaud. I haven't seen that extended to the area where, as individuals, we tend to think that other traditions have a lot to teach us. I think there's still room for good developments in that regard.
To that end, we look forward to seeing what you come up with for the theology volumes. Do you have a projection, a general guess as to when that will be ready?
Well, I'm hoping that the first volume should see print early in 2013.
Well, we'll look forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us today.
You bet.